Thomas More aims to share his exploration into grounding the pure, visionary spirit into what he calls the imperfect, intoxicating sensuousness of worldly life, knowing full well it's a mutual conversation for the times. 20 years ago, he wrote the New York Times bestseller Care of the Soul, and his latest, newly released, is A Religion of One's Own. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Thomas More, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you.
My pleasure, Robin.
You've been writing quite prolifically about spirit and soul for many years. What compelled you to write A Religion of One's Own?
One of the main things, or main motives for me, was that as I travel, I meet people who are telling me that they are no longer going to church and they're not interested in religion anymore. And they don't know what to do, and a lot of them feel they have a choice either between religion that they've known or a purely secular life. So I wanted to write a book that would help them and give them alternatives.
It does seem like we've moved in popular culture out of that God is dead phase.
Yes, we have. I think we've evolved from it. I thought that was an important phase to go through, that we needed to get rid of some of our very naive notions of the divine or God. And what that's done, it's led us, I think, to a new place where the institutions just don't work anymore. I mean, people really want them to, but they don't. It's just that they think they can't even explain it. I think it's one of those cultural shifts that affects everybody. Not everybody, but a lot of people. And it's difficult to pin down and explain, but everyone feels it.
Yes, and I think a very obvious... It's just such a perfect system in my mind, because you see the top-heavy government and agriculture and everything, and what it's led to is back to the community. So I think it's a parallel thing going on here that you're speaking about.
Yes, I think you're right. There's a movement toward more local life, even as we get more global. It's very interesting to see that.
Yes, more personal.
Moves in two different directions. And what I'm talking about is one version of that, the bigger picture.
Yes, and you seem to use the word religion in your book like most use spirituality, and I'm wondering if it's an important distinction here for our discussion.
It is an important distinction, I think. And one of the reasons it is for me is that I like the word religion. I mean, you know, I have a PhD in religion. I'm not going to give it up.
So I better like it.
Not only that, but I've been interested in religion all my life. I really love the spiritual and religious traditions of the world. I really love my Catholic Christian background, although I see lots of problems, very serious problems. I wish that they would deal with those problems. But nevertheless, I really love the religious traditions. And what I want to do is reimagine the word religion. It's, in fact, just that natural for me to think of religion as responding to the mysterious, those things that we can't explain, or the most sublime values that we can have. So I think that's what religion is. It's an experience. It's something we do. It's not an organization or a set of rules.
Yeah, certainly not. In talking about creating a personal spirituality, you say religion isn't complete without an ethical vision. What do you mean by this?
Well, what I mean is this is where we have a problem with the spiritual movements. So many times you get the sense that spirituality means taking care of yourself, making self-improvement progress, that you learn to meditate or do yoga, or you find a really good community to be part of. It's a lot about oneself. And I don't hear as much about ethics and about responding to the needs of the world and the world community. It's not as strong and not as much a part of that spiritual activity as I think it ought to be. That's why I make a special point of that, that it's with religion, this religion of one's own, even though I use the phrase of one's own with echoes of Virginia Woolf, with that kind of attitude, sort of progressive attitude behind it. I don't mean that you just do this on your own. You make up your own religion and great, and everybody else sort of go off and do what they want to do. That's not what I mean. I think that when you do this, you become more sensitive to the needs of the world, and you actually have a more intense sense of community, although it won't be so local, maybe, or maybe not people that agree with you, but people in the world generally. And you feel the need to respond ethically from your own religion.
Well, it is such a personal journey. Every individual on the planet has a different experience throughout their life, although it's just like different flavors of ice cream. Well, we're all eating ice cream here.
Yes, that's true. We're all eating it and enjoying it, and we know what it is, but it's all very different for each person. I like to quote Emerson, who said that every church has a membership of one, ultimately because each person takes it in their own way and makes it what they need to for themselves, even though they're part of a community. So in some ways, this question of community and individuality is one of those polarities that you can never resolve. You have to be a real individual in order to be part of a community. Otherwise, you're in a collective of some kind. And you have to be in a community intensely, otherwise you don't really become an individual. So they work together.
Yes, absolutely. Speaking of working together, now that we've moved out of the God is dead phase, it seems currently a theme in our culture is all about bridging science and spirit. And I'm wondering how you interpret that.
Yeah, I'm not very good at it because I feel too negative about science. I've tried, but I have to leave that for other people who are much more, feel more for the sciences. I love science in a way, and yet I think it's done in a way that bothers me. For example, I attend quite a few lectures. I have attended lectures on neuroscience. And what really bugs me is that these people are telling me now that all these things I've studied from the philosophers and from the religions are right. They're telling me that I'm right because they've proved it in the laboratory or in the brain or something.
I know.
That really bugs me because that's a materialistic attitude, and it's very superior. It's as though that you can't really get anywhere just through thought and reflection and art.
Yes, that's a huge misnomer for sure. And, it's like we don't have to bridge an apple with an orange.
No, that's right. I think that we could, though. I mean, ultimately, I'm not going to be able to do this work, but someone has got to redo science so that we really do, truly find science a portal to mystery, and where science becomes much more connected to the religious impulse, so that the science we do has soul in it, and that it does connect up with our spirituality. Again, this is something Emerson wrote about in his couple of his essays, one on the poet and one on nature, where he says only the poet can really understand science.
Well, I think that in speaking about that, it's really speaking about the mystery and anything. And I would say everything leads to the mystery, leads to that personal religion. How many stories have we all heard about the scientists, or Edison? They just couldn't figure out what they were trying to figure out, and they fall asleep and wake up with the answer. So it all emanates from that mystery.
Yes, it does, and it also points to the mystery, ultimately.
Yes, yeah.
Because when we, for example, just recently, astronomers announced that they think there might be other planets within our solar system, larger
wow.
than the Earth. Well, that discovery, if it's true, has real implications that are philosophical and religious and theological and spiritual, all these things. And we need people who can reflect on them intelligently and be part of the discussion. But we leave it all to the scientists, and that's where I think we go wrong. And we keep this materialistic way of life going, and I don't think we can survive at that level.
And once again, we're coming back into that community. Just the fact that people are talking about bridging science and spirit is a sign that there is becoming more and more that knowledge that we need to embrace it all and not just feel like one thing is it, especially in the materialistic viewpoint.
I hope that's right. There are signs, certainly, of that. People are always pointing that out to me, telling me that I better catch up with science, you know, because it does have these mystical possibilities. But the thing is, when I read a paper and read about all these discoveries, I don't get that. I don't get the philosophy and the theology as part of it. It's all given to the to that factual approach of what can be measured. And what we need to do is really be serious about getting the poets and artists and theologians and philosophers to get them in the discussion so that our very way of imagining what's happening in our world is richer and has layers to it.
Absolutely. I love stories about mystics, and you are such a knowledgeable historian of religion. I'm wondering if you would tell us a story.
Oh, a story about mysticism?
Or a mystic through the ages,
oh.
You know, back in history.
Oh, yes, sure. One of my favorite mystics is someone that I'm sure people don't read regularly, Nicholas of Cusa. Nicholas of Cusa was actually a cardinal in the Christian church. That means he was very high level in the organization, but he was a mystic. And like many of these mystics, he started as a mathematician. And he had a mystical experience one day when he was on a ship looking out at the night sky, which is a good place for mystics. And the content, what he learned in that flash of infused knowledge, you might say, what he learned was that how important it is to know exactly where you don't know anything or where you're ignorant. And he sat down and wrote a book it's called On Cultivating Ignorance. And to me, that's a beautiful book, one of the most beautiful books I've read. And it's called Negative Theology. It means that you, through the discovery of your ignorance, you actually find your way ahead. You learn a lot and you become a deeper person. But he says you should know for yourself as an individual person what you don't know and what you'll never know. That's wonderful to me, because in our modern world we tend to think that knowledge is all about gaining more and more information. And Nicholas of Cusa is saying we have to lose information too. We have to discover what we don't know.
Yeah. And I think, truthfully, there's a very direct way to do that, you know, and getting back to creating one's own religion, is it anything more than just going inside and listening?
Yeah, I think it is, because I think that the thing about religion, here's where it differs from spirituality, too, to some extent. Religion has always been a matter of doing, putting up buildings. That's interesting to me, that religions put up buildings, no matter what religion it is. You have a mosque, or you have a temple, or you have a church. And with Thoreau, you have a cabin on Walden Pond, which is the same inspiration, the same idea. So I think religion is quite concrete. And we have rituals, we have music, we have poetry. We have all kinds of things connected to religion as a practice. So I think it's more than just going inside yourself. It's that you do go inside, you have your mystical experience, but then you go out and you're spiritually creative. You make something tangible. In India, they build statues of the gods and goddesses, which is wonderful. You know, they have rituals for that, and they're very important. So I think in order to have a religion of your own, you have to find a way to make it concrete. And I think Thoreau's a very good example. Emily Dickinson, too, I use her because she just decided to wear white. Well, anybody could do that. I tend to wear black. It's my way. So, and I play the piano every day as part of my religion. So we don't have to do things that everybody does. But I think we have to really take it seriously and use our imaginations and really do it, really realize that we're going to have a concrete practice that is our own way of being religious.
I agree with you about having the concreteness about what we're doing, because that will only tend to lead us further in and really embrace all of that mystery, which allows it to flow from us even more. But I think what's happened with religions is that people get lost. So, you know, it's great. People in India are creating statues. But then, you know, they're for sale for a dollar in your store. The candle is for sale. And people buy that. And they buy it on a lot of levels. And one thing that's always, you know, created a mystery for me is, like, I am not one to be able to quote the Bible very well at all. But, you know, basically where you stand is holy ground. And yet, you know, the Indians, like, oh, this is a holy ground for the Indians. And believe me, I have respect, total respect for their ways and how they hold certain places. But I want to get to the ultimate. I want to get beyond any single space or anything having more meaning rather than the meaning itself, if that makes any sense to you.
I think I know what you're saying. I probably am closer to you in my own sensitivities to that, too. I used to be a very, you know, a practicing Catholic, and I did all that work with candles and holy books and rituals and communion and the whole works, and I still do it occasionally. But I've because of my experiences with depth psychology and world religions, I can't do that anymore in the same way. So I probably am more refined. That's not a good word. It's more subtle for me than it used to be. And in that regard, I feel like you. On the other hand, when I see what the people are doing in different parts of the world with their traditional practices, I want to be open to that. I don't want to say everyone has to do it the way I do it in the first place.
Of course.
And the other thing is that there's real value in those traditions. And some people choose to stay with them, and in some ways they're better for it than to be one of these subtle, you know, searchers like me. And the other piece of it is that I think it's really important that for those of us who want to create a very subtle form, I call it invisible. I don't want my own religion to be visible at all. I want it to be baked into my daily life. But those people who do it very visibly have a lot to teach me, because I can find out what they're doing in Africa and what they're doing in India and different parts of the world. And I don't have to go and do what they do and join up. And be inspired. I get some ideas from it.
Oh, yes.
And in that regard, the religious traditions are very precious to us, because I don't know where we would be inspired or educated and have them.
Thomas, you have worn and wear many hats in this life, including that of monk, priest, and psychotherapist. Does your counseling differ if someone is coming to see Thomas Moore, the priest, or Thomas, the therapist? And are you aware of the difference?
I'm not exactly sure what you mean. The idea of priest is pretty subtle. You know, I'm not a member of any religion, so they don't come to me for that. They come to me as a therapist primarily, but they know. And most people come to me knowing that two things. One is that I will go deep, and when I talk about soul, I mean going very, very deep into what's happening with them. I don't just try to help them manage their lives. We go deep, deep into who they are and what's developing mysteriously within them. And I also take seriously their spiritual quest, whatever that might be. I take that seriously as part of the whole picture. So I think that what I do, the kind of guidance that I offer, has that verticality to it that you may not find in, let's say, just recently I spoke to a group of coaches, and it's wonderful what they're doing, but what they're doing is something so different from what I do, because my way is more vertical. It's very up and very down, very deep and very high.
You talk early on in your book that the soul complains, whether you like it or not. And I'm wondering, what are some signs that you've experienced about your soul is complaining, and what do you do?
Well, a common way might be that I just might, asking for me, I would say I might get depressed. That's a complaint. I feel kind of depressed and not as happy as normal. I think, oh, what's going on with me? What's happening here? And it may be something in the world around me. It may be some inner development or something happening, that I have to look at. So the complaints usually inspire a person to reflect on what's going on. I always say people don't come to therapy when things are really peachy, when everything is wonderful. They only come, they would look at themselves when things are troublesome and they want to deal with it. So I what I'm trying to get at there is that the complaints we have, the feeling of disturbance, those feelings are important to help us keep in touch with what's happening within us. We probably wouldn't do it if everything is fine.
Yes, and you talk about religion implying action, and I feel like sometimes established religions stifle action.
You better tell me more what you mean by that.
Okay. I agree, and especially in talking about a religion of one's own, there is an action that needs to be taken. But once again, going back to the candles or the, go sitting in a church service for an hour once a week, that's not going to quite do it. There is a personal responsibility. There's a personal action that does need to be taken.
Yes, that's true. I think most of us would agree that just going through rote behavior, like going to church just because it's a habit and you just put your time in and then leave, that doesn't mean much at all. As a matter of fact, that might be injurious. It could be a problem for you. So that's not a good thing, obviously. So there are different possibilities there. One would be that you could search around and find a ritual that really does work and speaks to you, and that's possible. I talk to people who are, let's say, Christian and who are Jewish and a Buddhist who have found that their practice has become rote and meaningless for them until they began to study more or they found a teacher or a leader who was able to help them deeply into what they were doing. So it can be done that way. Another way is the way I did, of course, was get to a point where I said, well, this is really meaningless. I'm not going to do it anymore. But I didn't want to give up religion altogether. So I took a number of years to find my way to a more personal practice and way of life that is satisfying to me. And I guess it's been a lifelong kind of thing.
It truly is. And it's good to hear you say, there's patience involved. We're not going to walk on water tomorrow because we meditate for 5 minutes today. And so I think it's important for all of us also not to, anyway, it's important for me not to judge my own progress.
Yes, I think that's a waste of time. And it's full of ego. You don't need it. I think the thing to do is just relax. People ask me what some of my whole philosophy in two or three words. I say, lighten up. we got to relax. We're too perfectionistic, and we've gotten that from old time religion to be perfectionistic. Mm-hmm. We can give that up and just enjoy how rich life can be when you. When you let it happen and don't interfere too much. There's so much to learn. I learned a great deal from the Tao Te Ching on this point. The Tao Te Ching, the teaching is mainly about not forcing things. Let life take its course, they say, that the Tao Te Ching says. And that philosophy helps me. It's not the only one, but it's one that really helps me a lot, where I'm not trying to measure my progress and I'm not trying to get anywhere. As a matter of fact, this to me is one of the keystones of my own religion. I don't want to get anywhere. I don't have any goals. I'm not trying to achieve anything. I'm not trying to convert anybody. I write all these books, and I really don't care if people follow them or not. It makes no difference to me. I'm not there to convert people. I'm there to have a rich discussion about things. That's all.
Yes, and you do that very well, just with the feeling of a religion of one's own. It's pastoral is the word I want to use with it. It's spacious and very green, and there's a good feel. We're shortening out on time here, but I did want to ask you, while you were writing this book, you experienced both your father's and your best friend, James Hillman's, death within a few months of each other. Did you glean anything about death from either experience that you'd like to share?
Well, yes, they were both really, really significant experiences for me. I was with both of them toward the end, and my dad died at 100 years old, and he was in good shape and great humor and very, very, very bright-witted. And it was wonderful to be with him in those last months and weeks. I think what it did was remind me how much my father has been behind my work. And he was a plumber. You know, he'd only went to the second year of high school, but he was a very, very intelligent and wise man, and great at living life. So his death and his passing was like a turning, what would you say, like a giving me something. He gave me, I always feel that about death, that the dying give us something important. And my father gave me that whole history that we had together. And it inspired me now in my later years to to be like him, to not feel that life is over, and to keep going as he did right through to his 100th birthday. And James Hillman the same way. I was with him shortly before he died, and he and I were always having fun and talking to each other about ideas at the same time. We'd go out to dinner and have a great time, but we'd always be talking about serious things. And we're working hard. We both love to work. And he was there lying in his bed trying to get his last projects done before he died. And he told me, he said, "This is the worst deadline I've ever had."
Deadline.
And he was really, really working at that, trying to get these projects done. And there wasn't any time left, and he just hoped he would have it. He knew that he wouldn't be able to start anything new, but he wanted to get those things finished.
Yes, and I don't know, in a sentence, can you say, I know that now that A Religion of One's Own is in paperback print, I can only imagine you are knee-deep in your next book.
I am knee-deep in my next books, actually.
Okay.
I'm writing a book called The Spark of Life, which is an attempt to be more positive and optimistic and to be more inspiring in this work. I tend to avoid that. I like to write about the shadow, but in this case, I want to try to be positive without denying or losing the sense of the dark.
Thomas Moore, his latest of many books, A Religion of One's Own. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. And for podcasting on iTunes, Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.